Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. My guest is going to be Leah Penniman. She is the co-founder of Soulfire Farm and author of Farming While Black. And I'm just so thrilled to have her on. I have been privileged to see her speak a few times, and I am just really glad that she's able to join us. And I'll tell you more about Leah in just a little bit when she comes on. But first, I want to share with you some things in the news and some ways that you can take action. First off, yippee, we got a new president yesterday. It was just so amazing. Oh, I could cry just thinking about it. It was just wonderful to listen to him speak and to witness the hope. And who really blew it away was Amanda Gorman, the youth poet laureate who spoke. She's 22 years old, and she wrote a beautiful poem of hope and resilience and, you know, coming together. And it was just so inspiring. It was really beautiful. But these have been a long 4 years, and I'm just so happy to have hope again. And it's just great to, you know, to witness the first woman, the first Black woman, the first woman of Asian descent to take the stage and to be our vice president. Also great. So that's all wonderful. Okay. So I want to share with you all that this Saturday, I will be doing a cooking demo at the NOFA Winter Conference, which this year, for the first time, like so many conferences, are taking place virtually. And as much as it's sad to not all be together in the room, the good part is that you can, you know, listen to these recorded sessions at your leisure and your convenience, because so often, even when I'm at the conference, so many things are going on at the same time and I'm conflicted as to which room to go into. This way I can actually catch all the ones that I want at in my own time when I'm ready. And so that's really nice. But at my cooking demo, I will be wowing my guests with vegan appetizers. That's the theme. And I'll be making vegetarian sushi rolls, roasted butternut squash tapenade, and gluten-free potato latkes with some applesauce. So those of you that are registered for the NOFA conference, please join me. If you are not, stay tight, and I will get that recording and put it up on my website at some point so that you can watch it there. So ways that you can take action. There are so many things. You know, one of the things that came up with the election is that just because we now have our new president, we can't let up pressure. We got to keep it on. You know, there are so many things that he is committed to, you know, climate change, systemic racism in everything in our country, voting rights, immigration reform. There's so many things. And he's, you know, put together a $1.9 trillion economic relief package to help address the pandemic and the vaccinations. And all these things, you know, need all of our attention. We just can't let up. And I think that's one thing that this election showed, is that the power of the people, you know, even for the local elections, are so, so important. And we need to, you know, just keep on with all the grassroots organizations that we are committed to. One of the things I wrote about this week in my newsletter was pushing corporations to end deforestation in their supply chains. Back over 10 years ago, many of the world's largest companies like Nestle, Procter & Gamble, vowed to end deforestation in the supply chain by 2020. And here we are in 2021, and it's still not done. And so we need to put some pressure onto them. I don't know if you all realize that 30 football fields of rainforest are lost every minute. And that's a huge amount. And rainforests help mitigate climate change, and which is such a huge issue that we're all dealing with. So this is, you know, kills two birds with one stone. We keep the rainforest, we mitigate climate change, And it just, you know, does not make sense to keep cutting them down. Plus, we lose so many with the wildfires that we've been having. And, you know, weeks ago, I wrote about how many of our how many animals and plants are being lost to extinction every day. It's just really scary. So we need to really step up on that way. And then also, I just read about the first GMO pig being released into the marketplace. First, it was salmon back in 2015. Genetically engineered salmon was approved, even though there was a huge public outcry. You know, many large retailers have committed to not purchasing the GMO salmon. But I promise you, all those, you know, big chain restaurants are buying it up because you don't have to label it. It's cheaper and they don't care about the quality of the food we're eating. So now they have approved pig, and that's, you know, thank you to the Trump administration. It was just pushed right through without even the public knowing about it. This is the first I heard about it, and it's already been approved. So on my website, I have a way that you can sign a petition and let it be known that you are not in support of that. And now I'd like to share with all of you this week's recipe, which is, where's my recipe? This week's recipe, come on. Oh, I have it right here. This week's recipe is a tempeh with mushrooms, peppers, onions, and broccoli. And it's similar to a sausage and peppers recipe that I have done before. But this one is really delicious because it's made with tempeh that I roast in the oven so that there's no oil. And I've been, you know, really working on trying to do a lot more of my stir frying and sauteing using less and less oil. So this recipe uses no oil at all. So I cut the tempeh down the middle first horizontally so that I make the tempeh block a little thinner. And then I cut it lengthwise and then into cubes, about 3/4 inch cubes. And I laid those out on a cookie sheet lined with parchment paper. And though the tempeh I'm baking in an oven at around 350 for about 10 minutes until they're golden brown. And halfway through, I turn the pieces over so that the other side can get golden brown. But first, let me read all the ingredients to you before I go into the details. So you need 1 pound package of tempeh. So most tempeh comes in 8-ounce packages, but very often I buy a friend's tempeh. It's called Barry's tempeh. It's some of the local Whole Foods in New York sell it. And he uses tempeh that he makes with chickpeas. He makes tempeh with adduki beans. So, you know, I know a lot of people who are trying to avoid soy have a problem with tempeh. So this is a way of having tempeh without soy. So you want 1 pound package of that. 2 bell peppers, and I like to mix up the colors, orange, red, yellow, green, whatever you'd like. 2 yellow onions, 5 large portobello mushrooms cut into 1-inch pieces, 1 bunch of broccoli cut into florets, and it was about 4 cups worth of broccoli florets, 1 teaspoon of salt, 1 teaspoon of freshly ground black pepper, 1 teaspoon of dried oregano, 2 teaspoons of dried basil, 4 teaspoons of minced garlic, 3 tablespoons of tomato paste, 1.5 cups of Marsala wine, 1 teaspoon tamari, 2 15-ounce cans of fire-roasted tomatoes, 1/4 teaspoon of red pepper flakes, which is optional if you like things a little spicy, and 1/4 cup of chopped parsley. So like I said, I first cut the tempeh and roasted that in the oven. Then in a large wok, I first sauteed the onions for about 5 minutes. And like I said, I put it into a dry wok and just started sauteing it. And as it started to stick to the pan, I added 1 tablespoon of water at a time. And it's amazing that you can actually caramelize onions just using water. Then I added the peppers and the mushrooms, the broccoli and the garlic, salt and pepper, and cooked that all until the vegetables started getting soft and the onions were translucent, which is about 5 minutes. I added the oregano and the basil and cooked it just a little bit more. Then I push those vegetables to the side and let the bottom of the wok be empty. And I added the tomato paste right onto the bottom of the wok. And you want the tomato paste to just cook a little bit. It deepens the flavor and makes it just a little bit more rich and more umami flavor in there. And then once you've done that, then you're going to add the Marsala wine, the fire roasted tomatoes, and the chili flakes to that, and combine it all and mix it all up really well. Bring it to a simmer. You can cover it. Actually, add the tempeh first so the tempeh now can absorb all that flavoring. I've actually put in an extra can of tomatoes just so that the tempeh can add that up, because after you roast it in the oven, the tempeh is really nice and crispy, but it's, you know, does not have so much flavor in it yet. So you take that and add the tempeh into the wok. And let that simmer for about 15 minutes, and the sauce will thicken from the tomato paste. And right before serving, you're going to add the parsley. And I served it with some brown rice, but you can serve it with any other grain. You can serve it with rice noodles or whatever you'd like. And that is it. Really, really delicious. As always, I love feedback. So if you do make it, please let me know. Send me a little note on my at my website under comments. And that's it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce all of you to Leah Penniman. She is the co-founder of Soulfire Farm and author of Farming While Black. Leah Penniman is a Li Shi Ya El, is a Black Creole farmer, Payazan. I don't know what that is, and I'll ask her in a little bit. Mother, soil, nerd, author, and food justice activist from Soulfire Farm, which is in Grafton, New York. She co-founded Soulfire Farm in 2010 with the mission to end racism in the food system and reclaim our ancestral connection to land. As co-director and farm manager, Leah is part of a team that facilitates powerful food sovereignty programs, including farmer training for Black and brown people, a subsidized food farm distribution program for communities living under food apartheid, and domestic and international organizing toward equity in the food system. Leah has been farming since 1996. She holds an MA in science education and a BA in environmental science and international development from Clark University, and is a Maine queen mother in Vodon. And I'm sure she will have an opportunity to tell us about that as well. Leah trained at Many Hands Organic Farm, the Farm School, Massachusetts, and internationally with farmers in Ghana, Haiti, and Mexico. She also served as a high school biology and environmental science teacher for 17 years. The work of Leah and Soulfire Farm has been recognized by the Soros Racial Justice Fellowship, the Fulbright Program, Pritzker Environmental Genius Award, GRIST 50, and James Beard Leadership Award, among others. Her book, Farming While Black, Soulfire Farm's Practical Guide to Liberation on the Land, is a love song for land and her people. And I just have to say that I read this book as part of a book club with my board from NOFA New York, and it really helped us to really explore racism in the food system. And as one of, you know, the many grassroots movements that I'm involved with, it's just amazing how deep it is and that we don't even have a clue. So welcome, Leah. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Of course. My pleasure. So first, I just thought maybe you could share a little bit about your own personal history, how you came to, how you got into farming, and what inspired you to start Soulfire Farm.
Absolutely. So farming found me by accident. I was a teen who already loved the earth and loved social justice, but didn't know anything about farming, and was fortunate enough to be hired by the Food Project in Boston to work in both rural and urban farming, as well as food justice as a 16-year-old, and completely fell in love with that elegant simplicity of seed to harvest and the undeniable goodness of taking care of the land and feeding community. So I didn't quit. From there, I went on to work at the farm school in Athol, Massachusetts, and then to Many Hands Organic Farm, then worked with the Worcester Community Gardens program to set up their youth program with my partner. And Soulfire Farm itself came about because my family was living in the south end of Albany, New York, which is a neighborhood under food apartheid. And food apartheid is that insidious system of segregation that relegates communities of color often to food scarcity and diet-related illness. And we were struggling to get fresh food for our own young children. Ashima was two, Emmett was a newborn. There were no grocery stores, no farmers markets, no accessible public transportation, no available community garden plots. So when our neighbors found out that we knew how to farm, they started half-jokingly telling us that we should start a farm for the people to get food into that neighborhood. And of course, we took that pretty seriously and soon after wed ourselves to this rocky hillside in Mohican territory, Grafton, New York, that would become Soulfire Farm. So the farm actually opened in 2010 after 4 years of reclaiming and improving the soil, building infrastructure, building a home out of straw bale, timber frame, solar that we could move into. And then the very first project of the farm was a low-cost doorstep delivery of fresh food to the south end of Albany, New York. And, you know, of course, has evolved since then.
Uh-huh. And so the farm is still outside of that neighborhood. So it's not an urban farm in the neighborhood.
That's
it's outside.
Correct. We're a rural farm. We're about 35 minutes outside of Albany, New York, in a tiny town called Grafton. And we're about 25 minutes outside of Troy, New York, which is a smaller city between here and Albany.
Uh-huh. And how many acres do you have?
So we have 80 acres, of which we actively manage about 7. So we have a mixture of mixed vegetables, increasingly perennial small fruits and herbs, a silvopasture orchard, some chickens and ruminants, and then honey and mushrooms as well.
Uh-huh. Wonderful. Yolanda, who actually did a couple mushroom workshops up at your farm, used to be my intern. So.
Yolanda's wonderful. Yeah, so folks, if you have not checked out Soulfire Farm's YouTube channel, Yolanda actually helped us with a mushroom video on, you know, how to cultivate your own, and it's captioned in Spanish as well. So it's accessible. So please do check it out.
And she helped me here. We have shiitake mushrooms growing here on my property, and we did oyster mushrooms as well, which was much more involved than I expected and a lot of fun. So yeah, she's wonderful. So as I mentioned earlier, I read your book with my fellow board members, and we used it really as a tool to raise our awareness about racial injustice in the food movement. Can you share with us the impact that your book has had? Because I know, you know, when it came out, everybody was talking about it, and it took me this long to get you on my show. So maybe you could talk to us about the impact and how racism is so intertwined historically and presently in our food system.
Yes, that question is so important because a lot of folks, when they think about food, don't necessarily think of that as a racial justice issue. But the reality is that our entire food system is built on a DNA of stolen land and exploited labor and a practice of concentrating power and resources in the hands of the few at the expense of the many. So some of the ways that shows up are in terms of land ownership. So right now in this country, 95% of the farmland by acreage and 98% by value is white owned, which is higher than ever. And that's because of a whole legacy of theft of land from indigenous people, theft of land from Black farmers who had managed to amass 16 million acres by 1910, but between white supremacist violence and USDA discrimination, lost almost all of that land. It shows up in terms of farm worker exploitation. The Fair Labor Standards Act and the National Labor Relations Act do not include farm workers, which means that those who grow our food do not have the right to a day off in 7, the right to overtime pay, the right to collective bargaining, the right to workers' compensation, and so on. And the ramifications of that are huge. And, you know, we see this especially in time of pandemic, where COVID is disproportionately impacting folks that we call essential workers, but we really need to evaluate whether we're seeing the people as essential or just the labor as essential, right? Over 80% of farm workers are Latinx, Hispanic, yet only about 2% of farms are managed by that population. And then it also shows up in terms of access to food. I mentioned food apartheid briefly, but you know, we have a situation where Black and brown folks are disproportionately impacted by food scarcity, by kidney failure, heart disease, and other diet-related illnesses, not because of food choice, but because of a history of redlining and housing discrimination that forces communities of color to live in certain neighborhoods that have less access to these resources, lower wealth, less homeownership, and so forth. So the food system, really anywhere you look, ecology, capital, labor, land, has this racial injustice. And my hope with Farming While Black was to honor what Toni Morrison said, which is, you know, if there's a book that you need to read that hasn't been written, go and write it. And I felt like I had always needed a book that both explained the injustice in the food system, but also explained the powerful and beautiful contributions of Black farmers to sustainable farming and to just food systems. And so the book intertwines some of that history, uplifts Black agricultural practices, but also, you know, explains how to farm. It's a very practical book that has the stories woven around, you know, the spacing for carrots and how to save tomato seed and properly ferment it and all these, you know, basics of small scale regenerative farming.
And has the situation in the area where you live improved as far as access to food, as far as supermarkets in the town, or is that still the same problem it was when you first started the farm?
Oh, yeah. So even though we are doing doorstep delivery, it's just a tiny drop in the bucket what our small farm can do. I will say that there are other farms in the area who've adopted this type of solidarity strategy. So they're reserving a certain portion of their food or shares for folks who are low income and then establishing a fund to cover those costs. You know, there's some gleaning programs, but the fundamental structural pieces around how do we get those farmers markets and supermarkets and transportation have not been addressed. I think the city of Albany still has yet to form a food policy council and doesn't take those issues really seriously. So we have a long way to go, and individual citizen action is just one piece of it. We really need the structural change.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this was the first president that actually mentioned systemic racism in his speech. And I think, you know, one thing that the pandemic did, besides get number 45 out of the White House, because I always say if it wasn't for the pandemic, you know, the economy would have been good, people would have had jobs, and, you know, as we saw how close the election was, he probably would have won. So thank, you know, that's a silver lining of the pandemic. But, you know, one other thing the pandemic did is it really shed a light on the inequality and the health impacts that diet has on one's susceptibility to a virus like this. Can you talk about a little bit about how the pandemic has disproportionately affected communities of color and what you see needs to happen to improve that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we already know that there were, you know, over 700 outbreaks of COVID in meatpacking plants and food processing plants, which disproportionately impacted Latinx and Hispanic farm workers, and that the rates of morbidity and mortality were higher. And this is not because of some, like, genetic or physiological difference between Black and Brown people. It's because Black and Brown folks tend to be more often in positions of where they have to go to work in person as essential workers and often in crowded and unsafe conditions. There's a lot of racial disparity in terms of who can work remotely and work from home in these computer-oriented jobs and who actually is doing the work of sanitation, of driving, of feeding people, of processing and the nation's food. So that's huge. You know, additionally, what we're seeing is that disproportionately Black and Brown folks are often in housing conditions that are overcrowded, are relying on the emergency food system, which was strained, have less access to medical care and early intervention, or are not believed by the medical system, are more likely to experience job layoffs, to have pre-existing conditions because of environmental racism, to be in the wage economy without worker protection. So these preconditions of structural racism are really what have led to the disproportionate disease burden in communities of color. And fundamentally, if we address that, if we address inequality, if we address poverty, if we address racial inequity, then we would also see.
Can you share with us some of the programs that Soulfire Farm has, where you're teaching farming, but also how you're addressing racism and injustice in the food system and teaching that so that we have more people out in the world spreading that message?
Absolutely. So there are three basic program areas at Soulfire Farm. So the one that I'm closest to right now, because I'm here on the farm as the farm manager, is actually taking care of these precious 80 acres using Afro-Indigenous heritage practices that capture carbon, restore pollinators, restore biodiversity, and then to get this food to the people who need it most in our community through our doorstep delivery, as well as our institutional partnerships. So that's really foundational, is this farm and what comes from the farm. The second program area is the farmer training and education. And so we work with youth, adults, elders. We have a number of on-farm and remote classes in teaching this type of farming. And so our most popular is a week-long residential program called the Immersion, which we had to put on pause this past year for pandemic, but we're hoping to be able to resume next year. But in addition to that, we have our webinar series, we have one-day classes, we have our Ask a Sister Farmer youth programs and so forth. And all of that is striving to provide inspiration, knowledge, and resources to the returning generation of Black farmers. And we'll be announcing this year a very exciting fellowship program that will support graduates in setting up their own farm by providing a stipend and mentorship and more. And then the third program, as you mentioned, is public education and advocacy. So through our Uprooting Racism training, we're working with individuals and institutions to understand systemic racism and make changes. We educate policymakers about the needs of farmers, farm workers, and the earth. And we work with a number of coalitions like Heal Food Alliance, the National Black Food and Justice Alliance, to make policy suggestions and also to build the institutions that we need for the farming community to really thrive, you know, financial institutions, land trusts, and more. So those are the three basic spheres where we work. So we keep pretty busy. You know, we're a tiny team. There's less than 10 of us are working. And we have a combination of hyper-local work as well as some work on the national scale. Oh, and I didn't mention, in addition to delivering the food, we also help people establish their own gardens in the Capital District. So through Soulfire in the City, there's a program where we support people with having a raised bed garden and provide the soil and tools and seeds and classes and all of that.
Wow. Busy, like you said, just 10 of you. So where do you get your funding from?
So we have a really beautiful diversified mix. We have some earned income from selling our value add products and our online store. We accept program fees on a sliding scale and speaking fees on a sliding scale. So that comprises about a quarter. And then we rely on grants, you know, donations and partnerships to fund the rest of the educational work.
Uh-huh. That can be a full-time job just alone, writing grants.
Right. Absolutely. Right? Yeah, shout out to our communications director for managing that. Cheryl does a beautiful job.
Uh-huh. Good. Good. Yeah. You need someone really to focus on that. So one of the things that you talk about in your book are reparations to people of color to try to equalize the playing field a little bit, try to give back to what was stolen. Can you explain a little bit what is meant by that and how that will work? Because I know for some people, white people, you know, that can kind of like be a little scary. They don't know what that means. You know, are they going to come and take my land? You know, they don't. It's really something that's just not understood. So could you shed some light on reparations?
Absolutely. Yeah, reparations shouldn't be a scary word. It just means repair. And there's a story that I think can help illustrate it, which is told to me by one of my mentors, Ed Whitfield, who said, you know, imagine that your neighbor came and stole your cow in broad daylight. Everyone saw them do it. And then a couple of weeks later, comes back over to your home with remorse in their hearts and tears in their eyes saying, I'm really sorry I took your cow. It wasn't right. You know, I want to make it up to you. So every week for the rest of the cow's life, I'm going to give you half a pound of butter. Now, I don't know about y'all, but I would actually prefer my cow back. And we're in a situation in this country where a whole lot was taken from people. Millions of acres of land just stolen with no compensation, no consent. trillions of dollars of wages and this taken without consent. And it's one of the reasons why in this country today we have a wealth gap such that, you know, a white child born in America is on average 16 times wealthier when they take their first breath than a Black child. And it's not because of stolen wealth. And so what we have to figure out is not pretending that this history didn't happen and that the inequalities will just go away if we start from today moving forward and being nice to each other. We have to say, how do we really fairly share the land? How do we really fairly share the wealth? Like, should anyone be as rich on the planet as Bezos is, right? Is that even conceivably justified? So what does it look like to have a wealth cap or a wealth tax? What does it look like to take some of the forfeited lands that are currently abandoned and put them into public trust so that they can be shared with people who don't have access to land and more? And there's, you know, the nation is so afraid of this conversation that we have not even been able to pass HR 40, which is a bill that would allow a commission just to study reparations. And so I think hopefully we can agree that we could at least talk about it and at least think about some strategies. And there are many other countries who've successfully figured that out. Germany, you know, South Africa have had truth and reparations processes. So we're not starting from scratch. You know, we had a reparations process here in the US around the internment camps where Japanese families were compensated for some of their losses. So there's precedent and there's UN policy about the five parts of reparations. So I think we need to join the global community in really taking seriously the harms of the founding of this nation and figure out how to make it right so that we really do have fair society going forward.
Yeah, it's definitely something that needs to be looked at because it's accumulative too. Like you said, over years, you know, it multiplies, you know, as a young person, you know, you're told to like put money into your 501k from the very, you know, from when you're in your 20s because it multiplies and it turns, you know, even if you're just putting a little away every week, it multiplies. And that's, you know, the same as it would have been for land through generations. So you can understand, you know, you can imagine how big that gap is, and we see it played out, obviously, how big that gap is with land that has been stolen and has not been kept within the family that owned it, and that wealth be passed on from generation to generation and continue to grow. So it's, you know, it's really wonderful to have people like yourself who's really putting it out there and, you know, getting white folks to think about this. You know, I can talk as a white person, you know, it hadn't crossed my mind really. I hadn't really thought about it prior to really this discussion with the book. And so yeah. I just want to thank you so much for, you know, raising that awareness, because it certainly wasn't intentional. It was, you know, at least from, you know, it was an inherited horrible thing that has been compacted over, you know, hundreds of years. So this is not something new, you know?
Thank you for that. And I'll add one more thing about it, which is that even though I think that the entire society is obligated to look at this and address it at a policy level, that's going to take some time if it ever happens. And so we did develop a tool called the Reparations Map, which encourages individuals to think about what they can give in the spirit of reparations. And so if you go on our website, it's there, and it's a map of Black and brown-led land-based projects across the country and some international, with a list of what they're looking for, whether it's technical assistance, money, land, a tractor. And so folks can check that out and see what resources they might be able to offer in the spirit of reparations, just so that, you know, if we're not waiting generations for the government to catch up, we can start to do what's right now.
Great. So how has the awareness of the social and racial justice within the grassroots movement, how does that intersect with climate justice? Because I know it used to be just climate change, and over the past year, it's really become more climate justice. And we've seen how, you know, climate justice also is impacting people of color more often than white folks. And, you know, and they're also intertwined. I just thought maybe you could talk a little bit about how this racial justice is merging with climate justice and making an impact.
Well, I'll share. I actually just had a beautiful conversation with Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson the other day, who is the editor of All We Can Save and a well-known ocean and climate scientist, really, really brilliant person. And something I didn't know, which I was embarrassed that I didn't know this, is that when you survey the population about who thinks that climate change is an important issue, people of color rank it as a more important issue than white people by over 20 percentage points. That is really significant. So I think there is a misunderstanding or misnomer, first of all, that environmental concern is a white thing. So that I'm exploring. But to answer your question directly, I think when we talk about the intersection of racial justice and climate justice, we need to look at the fact that the people who are most impacted currently by climate change are often communities of color. If we look at extreme weather events like hurricanes impacting the Caribbean and the Southeast, and whose homes are getting flooded or destroyed, whose businesses are being lost, it's often communities of color who may be more vulnerable as well to not receiving the federal aid because of issues with title or being renters. You look at the wildfires in California and who's out there actually fighting them, you know, incarcerated people and farm workers. By and large. So who's suffering from heat strokes? Again, farm workers. So I think it's very important to look at folks being most impacted. And additionally, where do the solutions lie? We know that it is predominantly the wealthy white countries in the world who are responsible for causing the problem. And when we look at solutions, you know, regenerative ag, small-scale livable communities, these are solutions that are often held in communities of color about how do we live in right relationship with the earth. So it's really on all levels. It's on impact, it's on solution, it's on who's concerned. It is not just simply a charitable thing that white folks should be reaching out and, quote, including people of color in the climate conversation. It really is that if we want to win, we have to work together, you know, all of us across difference. To make the solutions to protect and make our planet livable for generations to come.
Mm-hmm. And in your work, how have you seen the industrial and corporate dominated food system? Let me rephrase this. We know that the industrial corporate dominated food system is part of the problem, that there's so much power behind corporations driving our food to be unhealthy. In your work, how do you try to mobilize people for that? Do you try to raise awareness for that? What kind of connection do you make with the larger food system versus the local food system that you're promoting?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that something that's been a big learning during this time of multiple pandemics is that the cracks in the industrial food system were really laid bare. Industrial food specializes in efficiency, but efficiency is rigid. And so when everything changed overnight and the food system needed to pivot to make food available in ways that it previously was not, you know, the school food, the restaurants, that didn't make sense anymore. We needed curbside pickup and, you know, feeding families and all of that. The industrial food system could not pivot. And so we saw the empty grocery store shelves. We saw the disruptions in supply chains. And in the meantime, you have our small scale regional food systems that were able to adapt almost overnight. You know, people building websites for farmers, you know, arranging delivery for elders, the ramp up of the CSA movement, like overnight. So that was really powerful to see the resiliency of the local food system. And I think that is its strength. In a similar way, when you measure yields in industrial food, you know, a one-year yield of a commercial system is going to beat out in terms of pounds or calories, a farm like ours over 1 year. But once you stretch that out to a 4 or 5 year yields study, you start to see more comparable output because these local sustainable small scale food systems can deal with drought. They can deal with pest outbreaks. They can deal with crop failure. They can deal with flooding because they're diversified, because they're resilient, because they use climate stable practices. And so that balances out over the longer term. So part of the way we're trying to address that is through public education and through modeling the ways that these systems really can be resilient and get food to the people in the face of an increasingly unpredictable societal and climatic environment.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of our problem with the myths in, you know, fake news, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, even the reality about our industrial food system is somewhat fake news. We're given, you know, Anna Lapke does a lot of the myth, you know, busting, you know, that through industrial agriculture, we can feed the world, that there's more yields from industrial agriculture. And like you said, over the long term, that has not proven to be the case. We were promised larger yields. We were promised less use of pesticides and herbicides. And none of that has really panned out. As we know, all the pests have mutated, the weeds have mutated, you know, survival of the fittest, you know, they're going to mutate just like this virus is mutating now, you know.
Absolutely.
And as a result, we're using more chemicals, more pesticides and herbicides, and you know, and in our healthcare system, just, you know, they're not integrating, they're not seeing the connection that they need to. Thank God some doctors are and are really speaking out, but the bulk of our medical system, you know, still is trying to just, you know, fix the symptoms with more drugs, and they're not thinking of food as medicine and how the foundation of our health is really basic, and it goes back to food. It's just such a frustrating situation, because it's, you know, there are all these perceptions that people have that we need GMOs. I mean, I interviewed some wonderful doctors last week who wrote the book Body on Fire, all about inflammation in the body. And they were talking about, you know, they've really made the connection about food as medicine. Mm-hmm. And yet they still weren't convinced that GMOs were not a good thing, because, you know, they think you might need GMOs to feed the amount of people we have. Do you have any suggestions how to break that myth? How to get, you know, even, like I said, even, you know, medical people who have made the connection that food is medicine, and that that, you know, eating more plant-based is going to, you know, make somebody healthier and less inflammation in the body. How do we combat, you know, genetically modified foods and get the word out that that's, you know, not the way to go?
Well,
you just heard thing about the pig, right? They're now genetically modified pig.
You know, honestly, I'm a little stumped by that, because I am surprised by the power of fake news in these times. And so if I were not jaded by the events of 2020, I would say we just need more research and information. And they're really, the research dollars are not going into proving the points that you're trying to make in a way that's translatable for the audience that you're talking about. And, you know, I would hope and assume that doctors and scientists would not be as susceptible to fake news, and that's more of a PR and general public issue. But I do think we need the investment. I think we go a lot of times on anecdote, or we go on limited studies that are done by the Rodale Institute or other insiders. And if we can really invest in more comprehensive data-driven solutions to some of these perennial problems of how we feed the world, we'd be in good shape. I know the World Resources Institute has done some good preliminary work on that, but there's a lot more work to be done in the realm of solutions. So I'm going to hold out that truth will prevail. And if we if we do that right, then we'll be able to win folks over. But we also need to demonstrate it. You know, we need to just show on more small and medium-sized farms that these techniques work over the long term, and feed people in a way that is replicable and scalable.
Mm-hmm. So what are you planning for 2021 at your farm? Are you being optimistic, thinking we're going to be back in person for this season?
We are planning on it. I mean, we pushed our summer programs kind of as late as we could, stacked them up more towards July, August, in hopes that, you know, the vaccination campaign has been successful. But in absence of that, we've reduced the numbers of all of our programs so that it is possible to be outdoors and socially distanced and have a low risk environment for on-farm learning. So we're planning for that. And then of course the new fellowship program will be coming out to support farmers on their own sites. We're going to continue with a lot of our online programming. We love how accessible online programming is. And so that isn't going to stop. And we'll continue to feed the community, build gardens, and, you know, train that next generation of farmers.
Yeah. Well, I was just so thankful that I had my garden and my outdoor projects this summer, because that was something that we actually could do and still maintain some distance and be together on the farm. So, that was a really another blessing this year during the pandemic, for sure. How large is your CSA program?
So we've actually broken it up. So we have the doorstep delivery for families, and then we have additional families who pick up through institutional partners. So if you add up, the Refugee Center, Focus Churches, Free Food Fridge Albany, and the doorstep, we're reaching about 150 individuals through those different channels. So pretty small. And some people are getting, a full share, and other people are just getting a couple of items. And then through the online store with our value add, we move, a couple thousand units of value add products as well.
What value added products do you make?
Herbal teas, salve, soap, preserves.
Uh-huh. And do you have those online that people listening to this show can go?
We do. Our inventory is a little low this time of year because people bought everything for Christmas and the season hasn't started up again. But yes, if you go to soulfirefarm.org and click on the store button, you can see the products that we have.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And so what are you working on besides the programs that you're starting up again for 2021? Do you have any hopes for expansion of your farm, or is it good the way it is? And one of the things that it looks to me like Soulfire Farm is a model, it's replicable for other farms. Is that a system that other farms can take and get started somewhere else?
Yeah, so our idea of growth is just that. We're not trying to make our farm big. We are trying to inspire and support other farms and food-based community projects through our Train the Trainer program, our fellowship program, advising, mentoring, land link services, and other supports. And so for us, success really looks like seeing more and more community-based grassroots food and farming projects pop up all across the country that are serving the unique needs of their own communities.
Uh-huh. And what are some of the challenges that an urban farm would have that you have to address as opposed to a farm that's, out in the country?
Well, I think land tenure is one of the biggest issues that urban farmers are facing, especially community gardeners, because oftentimes their lands are public lands or city lands or squats. And so as soon as it becomes more convenient to develop that parcel, they have the risk of losing all of that they've invested into the soil and their plants and community. So that's a really big issue, is permanent protection of urban gardens. And then I think additionally, just the limitations on space. I mean, we're very blessed that, we have all the space that we want for silvopasture and forest products and all of that with our 80 acres. But when you're confined to a smaller lot, you have to do a lot more vertical growing and, picking quick succession crops so that you can get something out of the small space that you have. And then the final challenge is contamination of soil, lead and arsenic especially. So making sure that get your soil tested and, if needed, use raised bed gardens with a liner to make sure that people aren't coming in contact with any contamination.
Uh-huh. I'd love to ask you about arsenic because, we've heard about arsenic in the rice, and how, I always tell people when you're making rice now, instead of just doing one cup rice to 2 cups water, that it's really best to first run the rice under water and really kind of scrub it, almost wash it, and then to cook it almost like you do pasta in a large pasta pot. You know, I'm putting my 2 cups of rice in a big pasta pot of water to remove, you know, 90% of the arsenic. But what is causing the arsenic? Has arsenic always been there and we're just finding out about it now, or is this a new development?
It's a good question. I'm not as familiar with arsenic sources for the rice. I think that actually has to do with where the water is being tapped in those communities in Southeast Asia. I'm more familiar with and have done a lot of research and work on lead in soils, which of course comes from paint as well as leaded gasoline prior to 1984. And it's just never been cleaned up. And we've measured really insidious lead levels as high as 11,000 parts per million in community gardens in Worcester, Massachusetts, back when we were doing soil remediation. And that's Superfund site. That's incredibly toxic. You're not supposed to go over 400 ppm for safe soils. And so there are ways to deal with it, including stabilizing the lead under permanent barriers or trying to remediate the lead through phytoremediation, which is using hyperaccumulating plants over a season or two to try to pull out some of that lead and get the levels down. So, but lead, of course, is a neurotoxin. It causes developmental delays in children. So it's very serious to try to get that out of the soil.
Yeah. The arsenic, I've actually heard that there's less arsenic from the rice in Southeast Asia. It's more out in Texas and California.
Okay.
That there's so much arsenic in the rice. So yeah, I don't know if they've been able to remediate that or what. I haven't really looked into it recently, but I just know it's been a problem for many years already.
Says that rice is an accumulator of arsenic. So that's why that there are some pesticides or chemicals that have arsenic that have been used.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's
so
Google search. I don't know.
Uh-huh. Going back to your farm, what vegetables do you grow? Do you grow, or do you have any special crops that you grow that are more indigenous to your community than, you know, just broccoli or?
We grow crops? Everything. I will say that I'm really partial to perennials and fruits. And so I love my strawberries and apples and pears and small fruits and herbs. But as far as heritage and cultural crops, a couple that we could highlight include the Scotch bonnet pepper, which is really central in Haitian cuisine, which is my maternal ancestry. We also have a Plate de Haiti tomato, which is a Haitian tomato variety that is really compact and firm and disease resistant. I love it. And sometimes it makes these funny protrusions that make you laugh when it grows, maybe like one out of every 20 fruits. We also, with the permission and instruction of the Stockbridge Muncie Band of the Mohican Nation, grow some of their ancestral maize and beans. And so we have maize mounds of the original people of this land. The fish pepper is a heritage crop. So we do make sure that we center some of our cultural crops in what we grow here.
Uh-huh. Do you have a good recipe for soup jumu? Is that how you say it?
Yeah, soup jumu is the national dish of Haiti. There's a great recipe on our website. Check it out. But essentially, you know, we can't grow the Haitian pumpkin because it's too cold up here. So we use a kabocha squash as a substitute. And it's the story of the soup jumu is that this very special pumpkin, which is a Taino food, was forbidden to the enslaved Africans in Haiti. But they were forced to prepare it for the white masters. And so when they successfully overthrew the French colonial slavers, they celebrated by making the jumu soup, this pumpkin soup. And so every year on the anniversary of that independence, which is January 1st, people make soup jumu. There's meat version. I have a vegetarian version. It's usually made with beef. But it includes squash and dumplings and all these wonderful vegetables and thyme is part of the flavor palette as well.
Yeah, well, I'd love to see your vegetarian recipe of it because I saw they shared a recipe of it in the New York Times, I guess during the new year. And I was inspired to want to make it. So I will definitely check out your recipe. Well, Leah, we're just about out of time. Do you have anything that I have not asked you about your farm that you'd like to share? Of course, we just shared the contact info so people can check out your website at soulfirefarm.org.
Well, I think the last thing I want to share is just a reminder that, you know, everything we do is really a we. So even though I'm the one who's being blessed to be in this interview right now, like, I couldn't do this without my awesome teammates, Jonah, Brooke, Kai, Cheryl, Larissa, Naima, Kiani, and everyone else, Dio, Azure. So I'm just so grateful. And I think that, you know, most things worth doing in life are worth doing together as a team. So
absolutely. And is your farm open for visitors? Can people
visit? We
are
closed during COVID, but hopefully we'll be able to resume our twice a month work and learn volunteer days starting in March or April. So people can keep an eye on our website for those. And there's a registration process for coming to those public days.
Okay. And do you have any other projects or interviews or, I mean, that we don't really have
all
events
the time.
These days.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, same thing.
Anything
on our website,
you share?
We have a calendar. We have a calendar so you can check out some of the events that we have coming up this week. My children are actually giving a keynote at the Jewish Farmers Conference on Sunday. So that's open to the public. There's a keynote at University of Kentucky on Tuesday, Plantarama on Tuesday. So yeah, absolutely. Check out our Real Organic Symposium, Ask a Sister Farmer. There's so much going on. So folks should definitely tune in and come hang out with us in the virtual space while we wait to safely gather in person.
Yeah. Well, in addition, thank you for mentioning the Real Organic Symposium. I'm a participant in that, and it's wonderful. And for those that don't know about the Real Organic Project, definitely check them out as well. They're a wonderful organization, really trying to keep the integrity in organic. And I think that's so important. Did you mention that you do some greenhouse growing, vertical growing? Are you doing vertical growing? You're doing.
We don't. I was saying that in urban spaces, when space is limited, you often have to think about what plants climb up. So
right.
More
right.
things that are trellis. So of course, yes, we trellis things, but we're not a vertical farm.
Yeah. You know, because also vertical farming still can be in soil. You know, I think the hydroponic thing that is such an issue in the organic circle is an issue. It's, you know, it's just not organic. So it might be pesticide free, antibiotic free, you know, or herb free, you know, there's benefits to it, but it's just not the same as organic. So just should have a different label. It should be hydroponic and people should know the difference. But
yes,
anyway,
I hear that. Yes, we use soil.
Great. I know you do. Thank you so much, Leah, for joining me today. It was such a pleasure.
Well,
I know how busy your time is.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a joy. Thank you very much.
Great. And I look forward to really meeting you in person when we can get back to that. And everyone who's been listening and joining us today, I want to thank you so much. You've been listening to Leah Penniman from Soulfire Farm, and I'm Bhavani at iegreen.com. See you all again next week. Have a great rest of the week, and let's celebrate our new 46th president. Amen. Bye for now.